But I just wanted to say that I totally identify with the girls in Guatemala because I remember going to fetch firewood while the boys went to play football. Totally unfair, but I get it. And I know the first presenter has talked to us about women in Malawi, so I'm going to transport those women from Malawi to the U.S. so we can relate to what happens to their health when they get here. But like they said, my name is Pamela. The principal investigator for this study is Dr. Ngewa, who is currently in Botswana right now, and she sends you her regards. And before I start presenting, I want to acknowledge one of the people that have supported this research and that continually support our work. My mom, sitting in the audience, Mrs. Joyce, from Uganda. And the one who sent us to fetch firewood while the boys played football. So I will be spending a little bit of time looking at acculturation and breast cancer screening behaviors among immigrant women in the United States. And we do not have any relationship to disclose. So just a brief background about cancer and women in the United States. When we look at the leading causes of cancer-related deaths in the United States, breast cancer is actually the second leading cause of all cancer-related deaths among women, all women in the United States. And overall, 1 in 8 women will develop breast cancer in her lifetime in the U.S., which is a very scary number. But when we look at health disparities are typically indicated in notable differences in incidence, prevalence, and disease burdens within populations. So some of the ways that we observe these disparities in the U.S. is in the cancer mortality and incidence rates among the black population. So very, very basically, white women in the U.S. are at a greater risk of getting cancer, as we can see, about 125 per 10,000 compared to African-American or black women at 116. However, black women have a greater risk of dying from breast cancer, and as we can see, these they have 1.3 times chances of dying from cancer than their white counterparts or the general population. Unfortunately, they also have lower access to breast cancer screening services and also are more likely to underutilize very simple procedures like self-breast screening, mammography, or even clinical breast exams. When we look at immigrant blacks, it's very interesting how the literature breaks the black population into parts. So they break it into African descent, Afro-Caribbean, and African-American. So when we just look at immigrant black women, we're typically focusing on African and Afro-Caribbean in the U.S. So what we know is that in the U.S., foreign-born populations are actually growing more and more over the last decade. And among those, the fastest growing subpopulation are immigrant black women or black in general. What we know from the literature is when they do get here to their host country, as they adopt to the social, environmental, and lifestyle changes, their outcomes, their health outcomes either improve or actually get worse in some ways. And over generations, they actually begin to mirror the same risk factors for cancer as women that have been in the U.S. for over generations. Immigrant black women, for example, have the highest mortality risk from breast cancer compared to other racial and ethnic groups in the United States. Breast cancer is the most common type of cancer for immigrant women. And again, typically because of the fact that they are not accessing services for screening, when their cancer is diagnosed, it's usually very late in advanced stages, which might explain why they actually will die at higher risk when they get cancer. So why of all the black immigrant groups, why focus on the Africans? From 2000 to 2010, the number of African immigrants in the U.S. actually doubled. So we're coming by the numbers, so a population that needs to be paid attention to. And in 2010, actually 12.5% of foreign-born population were African immigrants in the U.S. What we need to know about this group is that these immigrants actually have diversify the black population. So not only are they coming from different countries like, you know, Nigeria, Egypt, Ghana, Ethiopia, Kenya, but they have unique different histories, religions, cultures, languages, health beliefs, health behavior patterns, different lifestyles. And we know in health education or even health promotion that all of these things are factors that will explain differently their decision-making behaviors or how they're engaging with the healthcare system or how they're engaging in any type of screening specifically for breast cancer like we are concerned. So again, they mimic the black population in general in low breast cancer knowledge and screening services. And then why specifically the women in Washington, D.C.? So until this study, actually, I didn't know that the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan area is actually the largest home for African immigrants in the United States. So they somehow love the Washington, D.C. area, so they populate there. D.C., though, is actually has a very high burden for cancer as an area in the U.S. Apparently, from the Cancer Registry and CDC, the Washington, D.C. area has the second highest risk of breast cancer in the nation. And they are they rank seven highest for all cancers combined. So quite a big burden for cancer, particularly breast cancer. So now you're getting this area that has this burden for cancer-related outcomes, and of the population that lives there, 11% of immigrants that are new are African. Now, if we back up a little bit and understand what the World Health Organization is saying, is that these people are actually already coming from places that are, we're seeing an increase in cancer concerns. And I think the World Health Organization is estimating that by 2050 or by 2065, 70% of breast cancer rates in the whole world will be from sub-Saharan Africa. But what we know is that even back at home, and as they come to the U.S., this group already has a lack of insurance. They have modesty ways in which they discuss health issues, especially with issues, so they are something that they are readily going to talk about or not talk about as a group. There's lots of cultural norms that inform how they think about themselves as women and women's health and how then they will relate to any services pertaining to improving their health as women. Cancer is a taboo word, even saying it, and even in these years we were recruiting, just approaching somebody and telling them you want to talk about cancer, I was almost saying, you know, it might patch on you someplace. So just how they relate to cancer is huge. And then the fact that for those that end up getting the disease, the way they deal with the disease using faith or spiritual beliefs also takes away in some ways in how they might access care. And again, very low empowerment group and a sense of fatalism. Well, I got it because God will. If I won't screen, I'll just find out if I'm supposed to get it, whether or not I screen, I'll get it. So that fatalism perception about disease also makes them quite vulnerable, and it explains why they might or might not be seeking services. So we set out to explore how alcohol curation might influence breast screening behavior among this group, and secondly, to identify what cultural practices, if any, are influencing how immigrants in the DC area, one, understand and perceive their own risk of breast cancer and how they are assessing or engaging in screening behaviors for early detection of cancer. Participants, they had to be 40 to 65 years old to engage in the study. They had to self-identify as African, live in the D.C. metropolitan area to include D.C., Washington, Maryland, Virginia, and they had to read and speak English. So recruiting this, like you can imagine, was quite a challenge, but a fun one. You literally go everywhere that they might be connected. So places of worship, cultural centers, embassy events, ethnic salons, stores, local festivals, any place that they might they're likely to come. And advertising was by flyers, but we actually had a lot of help from the Office of African Affairs and a lot of smaller, again, organizations that either, you know, have events with them or talk to local leaders to bring them into the bigger picture of other cultures within the D.C. area. And the easiest way to sample them, of course, because they're very small, is not about sampling. Bring me your cousin, your friend, talk to your auntie and uncle, and we get rolling with the sampling. So we did this last year, July to, actually the previous year, July 2013 to June. Cross-sectional design for the study, very explorative in nature. And we did a self-administered questionnaire, you know, very simple questions beginning from demography, health access, utilizing screening services, to indicators of how well they are calculating to their new home in the United States. So this is the map of the study site. If you look at the green circle, those are the areas that we were recruiting. And just a few of the results. So when we looked at respondents' characteristics, it was interesting that when we asked them to rate their own health, a majority of them were self-rating at good or very good. When we ask about regular healthcare provider visits, we were very encouraged to see that 73% of this sample was actually having regular doctor's visits. It was also interesting because when you think about immigrants, you think about, you know, preference in care provider. Are they going to want male versus female or female versus male? But it was interesting that actually half of them had no preference on the gender of their provider. Some of the characteristics, you know, more than half were between the age of 40 to 55. A good majority of them had reported at least ever having had a mammogram, which was very, very good. 12% had a family history of breast cancer. Again, majority had health insurance. Very good, at least some level of education for a majority of them. Majority were married, and about 87% identified as Christian. When we look at other characteristics, age of first mammogram for these women, 50% of them were between the ages of 40 and 49. It was interesting though that when we were doing some very basic associations between demographic factors and likelihood or intention or actual practice of screening, we learned that women who are unmarried and insured and less educated were less likely to screen. Women who reported higher rates of stress were more likely to be screened for mammogram, and that was because when they go in for their general checkups and they ask about their stress levels, typically the provider will then, if they're highly stressed and they're continuously stressed, then the provider will recommend that they actually have a mammogram test. So sort of that works in their favor. If they are stressed, then they are likely to recommend that they take a test. And then there were generally lower rates of adherence for breast cancer screening guidelines. So, you know, very basic things like, you know, doing your own self-breast exam at home. Very few are doing that. The majority, though, reported intention to screen if their healthcare provider had recommended that they screen. And again, from asking them how many of them actually were having a provider recommend screening, we learned that very few of them, which is 63%, reported that their healthcare providers were recommending that they screen. So when we look at a calculation and breast cancer screening, I'm just going to give us sort of a basics about what a calculation means. It's very simply the process through which immigrants are expected to learn cultural patterns in their new home. For example, how are they doing with language? How are they, you know, adopting a new culture, new values and practices in their host country? And we used a bi-dimensional cultural scale, and this scale sort of looks at key indicators that might show us how well new immigrants are doing in their host country. And it measures linguistic proficiency, essentially how well are they speaking language? How often are they using language? And what is the exposure to media? So that gives us an indication of how well they are adopting. And it's a bi-dimensional scale because it does all of those three things in two domains. So we are looking at language proficiency, language use, and electronic use in the English language, which is their host country language. But we're also looking at exactly the same indicators using their native language. How well are they doing? Are they mingling both, and how well are they doing with that? Then the second measure that we used for calculation was exposure to the U.S. culture. So essentially, how long have they been in the United States, and at what age did they come in the United States? Because then that also tells us how quickly they're adopting, are adults adopting quicker, or are younger people that are coming at a younger age adopting quicker to their new culture and therefore getting new behaviors for health screening. And all of those we tested on a 24-item scale that gave us some indication on if their calculation is low, if it is high, or they are bicultural, meaning that they are navigating both their native background with the culture in their host country. So this is what the results look like when we look at both of those domains. And this is actually the primary predictor of how well they're adopting. So when we look at the first linguistic proficiency, how well they are speaking the language, we see that they were actually doing well both with their host culture language, which is English, and their native languages. Now, when we look at language use, it's interesting that actually using more English now that they're here than they are using their native languages. The same is happening for media. Of course, they're having more exposure to media that is in English versus native language culture. Then the bicultural scale, we're trying to figure out how well are they adapting to their new country. We found that 54, which is 3.1%, were actually not bicultural yet, even though some of them had been here for a longer time, like you will see. So then we're looking at the second measure of vocal curation, which is duration. And we found that more than half of these people had actually been in the U.S. for more than 15 years. And then we're also looking at what age were they when they came to the United States, and we found that a majority came between the ages of 20 and 39. So, you know, adults or young adults, so within younger careers, intermediate professional careers. So then we looked at what is the association of all the domains I showed you, the language proficiency, use, and media, and how is that and duration of time in the U.S. predicting how well they are taking on cancer early detection screening practices. Interestingly, we found that the only thing that predicted adopting new screening practices was how long they had been in the U.S. So whether or not they were speaking language well, they were adopting language, whether or not they were using electronic media within the English language didn't really predict their use of screening services like mammograms, but how long they had stayed in the U.S., especially those between 11 years and more, were more likely to be engaging in screening. So then what is our conclusions from this study? Is the duration, of course, like I said, in the U.S. was significantly associated with current practices and also intention to screen. Cultural beliefs, like I said, were not associated with current screening practices. Like I said earlier, because these people come from diverse countries, one of the recommendations we have is that it will be very interesting to examine these immigrants by region. So for instance, if we had the time and the money and were able to access women from Anglophone countries versus women from Francophone countries and understood their histories, their language, their cultures, and therefore how they are making decisions about health, would we find differences in how those relate to cancer screening practices for early detection? And then we also think that we can't overemphasize the role of healthcare providers in actually recommending screening for their patients, because like you saw, those that had providers recommend screening were more likely to screen than those who didn't have providers recommend. And then again, examining influences of different cultural frameworks within attitudes and disease and treatment, like we talked about fatalism, if it's God's will, or the fact that in some cultures, even saying cancer, your grandmother will slap you on the side, because essentially you're bringing the whole spirit of cancer in the house by just saying it. So understanding those things, those dynamics and cultural frameworks of understanding disease and therefore seeking early detection other than thinking it will catch you anyway if it's supposed to, would be something that would be very interesting to look further into. And then family history, like I say, the data is showing that cancer is actually growing, and we don't know if in the countries where they're coming from, and we don't know if it's just growing or if it's because more and more people are actually opening to detecting the disease. So if these people are actually coming from countries where we're seeing the disease grow, it's very, very important that family history becomes of what we ask them in the U.S. and have them sort of tell us what is happening from where they're coming from, so we are better able to put them in a high-risk group and therefore help them access detection services quite early. So thank you for listening. These are our references, quite a bit of work being done, very impressive work, and we were very delighted to just do a little bit with the groups that we are familiar with in the United States.
Thank you so much. Our last presenter wasn't able to make it, so I'm going to invite all the presenters up to the front so you can ask some questions. We have a lot of time for questions. So yeah, if you guys can all come and sit up here and you guys can all take turns asking interesting questions for all these really interesting presentations. And thank you so much for your really great presentation. So go ahead and keep answering. Yeah, and go ahead. Just ask, say who you want to ask a question to, or to the group, or and then go ahead and ask some questions.
My name is Ophelia Lutheran, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. My first question is for the last speaker. I know one of the correlations that you mentioned in terms of the English language. The fact that they were proficient. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you looked at the correlation between their proficiency and the educational level. Mm-hmm. So that's one question for you. Mm-hmm. For Dr. Mukili, my question for you, it is really good that you focused on the contextual portion of it, because we know that there is so much research going on in terms of HIV. And food insecurity is not necessarily a factor somewhere else. I'm wondering, since one of your recommendations relate to the adherence of all of those factors, if you all are considering doing any follow-up studies, because it would be rather timely, because so much, so many other pieces of research are being undertaken, but we wonder if there's anything longitudinal going on. And my other question for you, please, Louisa, I apologize for being long-winded. I know when the Central Michigan University did some diabetes clinic in Belize, one of the things that came up was perception of the young people. Though they may know, the idea that they are considered attractive by having additional weight. I'm wondering if that came up, and also wondering whether you mentioned 34.4% and 28.6% public-private schools. If your focus group reflected maybe almost that same percentage of the male population, and if that was considered in what came out of your focus group.
So first, the question is interesting, and the answer is yes, we did and found differences. And I think the reason might be is because when we use language proficiency as a scale of measuring how well people are doing, we assume that some of them are coming without English language. But the countries that I think, like Nigeria, Egypt, Ghana, are actually English-speaking countries. So likely, people are coming here already. You know, very good, excellent English language speaking anyway, which would make sense then that it wouldn't necessarily show up in how well they are doing, how well they are doing in the language. Does that make sense? So that would be the short answer. Okay.
And this is our next. Great question you have there. Yes, we actually are in the process of writing a grant to try to go back, because when we did this study, we promised the women of that region of Malawi that we would come back to wherever the family is and try to do something about it. So we are trying to write a grant that would allow us to provide food, you know, some type of access to food to this population of women, and then go back and do a longitudinal study to see if they're not having access to food, which was one of the factors that influenced their adherence. We want to see now that they have access to food, would that improve their adherence rate? So we are working on something like that. Thank you.
Okay. Girls do not think they are more attractive when overweight or have some extra pounds or something, at least in Guatemala. there are some beliefs about overweight, but I don't focus on them. Yeah, and about the percentages, I do not take that as a priority in order to make my focus good.
Does anyone have any other questions? Great. If no one has any other questions, they'll be available here to have you come and talk to them. And thank you so much for coming to this session, and thank you to all the presenters for doing such an excellent job in helping to really come through.